This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Jeanette Walls has written for Esquire and New York magazines. Her work has appeared in the pages of USA Today and on MSNBC.com. She graduated with honors from Barnard, so naturally you would expect that her parents prepared her for such success from an early age. You'd be correct in that assumption, but not in the way you imagined. Jeanette Walls was one of four children raised by parents who were unconventional by most standards. Her electrician father was an alcoholic given to big dreams that never materialized. Her mother was an artist, a free spirit, who believed that children needn't be coddled, and she followed her own advice. The four children soon learned to fend for themselves and succeed in spite of a vagabond lifestyle where there was never enough money, never enough food, and never any real sense of place. All of this is detailed on Jeanette Walls' book, The Glass Castle, which spent 100 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list when it came out in 2005. Well, now it's back on the bestsellers list, and The Glass Castle has been adapted into a movie starring Brie Larson, Woody Harrelson, and Naomi Watts.
Let's go, kids! Venture on our tails.
He means the bill collectors.
And if the subway's flat.
The kids are tired of moving to a new town every time you lose a job.
You know, all this running around is only temporary. We just need perfect location, then we can get to work on our castle.
The book grabs you from page one and doesn't let go. We spoke with Jeanette Walls about her book and her life in 2009, and this hour we listened back to that conversation recorded in front of a live audience at Lenore Ryan University in Hickory.
I could not wait to meet you today because I thought, what is she going to be like after this book that is just horrific in places? And you're perfectly normal. I'm so disappointed.
Oh, appearances can be deceiving.
You waste no time in this book setting up the internal conflict, which is essentially between you and your parents in this. How would you, for people who have not read this book, how would you describe your mother and father?
You know, they were wacky and they were dreamers. Some people think that they were monsters who should have had their children taken away from them. Some think that they were certainly flawed, but that they had gifts as well. You know, and I choose to focus on the latter. You know, my parents were flawed people, but I think that they had dreams. My father always dreamed that he would build us the glass castle. My mother was an artist, and she put her artist, her work ahead of taking care of her kids. And, you know, I can sort of focus on what they didn't do for us, but I choose rather to focus on the, sort of the magic, and I think there was some magic.
I read that you were actually shocked by some of the comments from readers and from reviewers after the book came out, because they each had their own take on your parents, and that kind of shocked you.
Well, you know...
You were a gossip columnist.
Yes,
nothing
I
should
was.
Shock you.
Well, you know... I think sometimes our own stories are our biggest shock. I was shocked the first time I read my own story back. I think we sometimes internalize things in a weird way and deal with them, put them in places when we can't deal with them. Some people have told me they were jealous of my childhood. I certainly didn't expect that. Some people just... A husband and wife team one time told me that the husband said he could barely read my book. He was crying so hard. The wife said, I was laughing throughout that. I thought it was the funniest thing. So I think we bring our own agenda to any situation. So people have wildly different reactions to my parents. Yeah.
What got me about your... When we have conversations about who we're going to talk to, I usually hem and haw and take a long time to decide, and they handed me your book, and I opened it to page one. I said, yep, we're doing it. Because on page one, you're driving in a taxi cab to a party on Park Avenue, and you look out the window, and your mother's going through a dumpster. How did you come to terms with the fact that your parents ultimately ended up living on the street?
You know, I didn't come to terms with it for a long time. I ran from it. It was a deep source of shame for me. I wanted them to go away. And I think seeing Mom on the street that day and asking her later, what should I tell people when they ask me about you? And she gave me the best advice anybody has ever given me. And she said, just tell the truth. And I think she was both challenging me to and giving me permission to tell the story. And I've become a big fan at this point of I think everybody has a story. That's been the other shock to me, is how many folks have come up and told me their stories. And I think the truth will set you free, but the truth is complicated, you know?
Well, you had been building a career in New York and living on Park Avenue and going to fancy parties and meeting highfalutin people and not telling anybody.
Nobody knew.
Not even your husband-to-be.
Right.
And finally he said to you, I'm not marrying you because I don't know anything about you. You know everything about me and you're hiding something.
Yeah, he was the only person who sort of called me on it. Most people were happy not to talk about me. They're happy to talk about themselves. So he was the first one who sort of said, things don't add up, Jeanette. Every time I ask you about your past, you change the topic. And he sort of, he pulled it out of me. And his reaction as soon as I told him the story is that would make a great book. He also told me later on he wasn't quite sure whether I was a little bit loopy and making it all up because he said it was so wacky. But then he met my mother and he said, you know, she's a little strange, but it's a great story. You really need to tell it.
Yeah. I would think that anybody in this room would be sympathizing with you on your embarrassment. But your mother was not embarrassed. Your father was not embarrassed. In fact, your mother thought that your priorities were wacky.
She thought my embarrassment was sort of hilarious. Yeah. Why would you be embarrassed? I am who I am. I am what I am. You know, and she just sort of thinks that it was my issue. And in a way, she's right. In a way, she's right that I just needed to come to terms with it. That, you know, I think that a lot of, and I guess that's one of the things that I've learned, how many people carry around their past, their secret. It's a source of shame for them. Mm-hmm. And one of the many things that I've learned since coming clean with my story is that a lot of us run from our past and hide our past. And if you try to do that, it catches up with you eventually.
I'm just curious how you did this. This is a memoir.
Yeah.
And it's incredibly detailed.
Uh-huh.
And it's got a lot of dialogue in it. And I'm sure that some of the dialogue is probably spot on. Because some of the words that were spoken are probably kind of the kinds of things that stick forever.
Yeah, right.
But some of it I'm sure you had to recreate. What was your approach? How did you do this?
I wrote down the sort of most traumatic, the most memorable scenes first. Being burned when I was 3 years old. Falling out of the back of a U-Haul. Rather, falling out of the back of a car and then being put in the back of a U-Haul. Being thrown in the hot pot. And the more difficult than writing that was actually sort of remembering what order they went in. When I wrote the first scene, I was 3 years old and I was burned cooking hot dogs for myself. And my husband said, Jeanette, this scene is really going to depend on detail. Write down absolutely everything you remember. So I said, okay. So I went and wrote it up and I showed it to him. He said, you can take some of this detail out, Jeanette. You know. So I remembered a lot of things that I couldn't put in. I think that I've talked to an expert in memory who came to one of my events and he said that traumatic memories are stored in a certain part of the brain where they're more accessible.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why so many people can remember all the details of what was happening when Kennedy was shot. Because it's sort of seared into your brain. It plays in a loop in your head. So I just wrote it to the best of my memory. You know,
but your whole life was trauma.
It indeed was. That's why I remembered so much of it.
And you've decided to tell the story through the eyes of a child.
Yeah, because when I tried to write it as an adult looking back, I found out that I was a journalist and I did gossip columns, but I would lapse into this weird journalism when I was trying to write about my past. I'd say, I had heretofore not considered the plethora of influences. I realized I used journalism to distance myself. And every time I tried to write it as an adult, I was really distancing myself. So I had the decision of writing it as an adult looking back or as a child going through these things and describing what really happened.
Yeah. It works. Did you make several stabs at it? Was that your initial decision
to
write it?
No. Well, actually, I tried to write it when I was younger. I tried to fictionalize it. And I have no imagination. I couldn't figure out what I was supposed to change. I wrote the very first version of this book in 6 weeks, and it was very bad. And that's not false modesty. I just sort of hammered it out in that bad journalism. And then I spent 5 years rewriting it and trying to be honest about what really happened and how I really felt about it.
Wow. Your mother had a philosophy of child rearing.
Oh, yeah, if you call it that.
It's unorthodox by today's standards and troublingly strange, actually.
Yeah.
You mentioned being burned at 3 years old because she allowed you to cook hot dogs for yourself.
Right.
Where did that philosophy come from? Where did that attitude come from? From her mother? From herself? How do you explain that?
You know, she's very passive and just sort of lets the world go by her. And she just, to this day, she just doesn't To this day, I mean, my mother lives with me now, not with me because I'm not a saint. She lives out back. We have a little place we put her out back, and she sort of just doesn't care about us kids, and that's okay. I've come to accept that. I love my mother, but she will never be a normal mom, whatever that means. And I love having her live there. I care about her. It's sort of like having, I hope this doesn't sound flip, it's sort of like having a barn cat. You're just like, she's amusing. I make sure she has enough food. I care about her, but she's never going to care about me. It's just not going to happen. It's just the way she is.
She doesn't, you think she doesn't care, really?
She's interested, but no, she doesn't look after me. She just doesn't, and she never has, and she never will. And that's just the way she is.
Now, I have to ask.
Yeah.
Do you think there's something wrong with her?
Oh, she's loopy as all get out, yeah.
No, but I mean, seriously, is there something mentally, definably mentally wrong?
She has never been diagnosed with anything, whether or not, I mean, if she went to see a shrink, I don't know if they would be, but she certainly sees the world differently than most people do. She, you know, we had to cut down the weeds in front of her. We call it the cottage, but we're putting on airs. It's a mobile home, but it's got heat and running water. What the heck? But we had to cut down the weeds in front of her cottage, and she started crying because she felt sorry for them. She said they have the same right to live as flowers do. So she sees the world differently than most people do, and I have to accept that. Is that mental illness? I don't know.
I know that you're writing a book, or you have written a book. It's
yes.
out about her mother.
Yes.
Was she like that in any way?
She was the opposite. My grandmother was a real disciplinarian. She was a tough old broad, and I say that with affection. She was a horse trainer and a school teacher. She was a poker player, and she ran bootleg liquor, and she just ran the world with an iron fist. She tamed the land, she tamed the critters, and she tamed the school kids. And I think my mother was the only creature she ever encountered who she couldn't tame.
So your mother's not the way she is as a reaction to her mother.
She
just is the way, oh, really?
A reaction against, I think she might be, yeah.
Your mom's approach, once again, to raising children, with tough love, paying attention or coddling children, made them weaker, didn't make them stronger.
I don't know if it's tough love as much as passive love. Just let them do whatever they're going to do and let them fail and hurt themselves on their own, and they'll learn not to hurt themselves again.
But your parents were kind of like peas in a pod. They weren't exactly the same, but they just kind of fit together like yin and yang.
Yeah, meshing neuroses, yeah. Uh-huh.
How did they meet? What attracted them to each other?
Well, I think that, you know, my father was in the Air Force, and my mother, and he was flying out in Arizona. I think my mother was drawn to his wildness, just the sort of the unbridled, you know, the chaos. She's just always loved excitement and chaos. And as I said, my grandmother was sort of trying to tame her and set her straight, and out came this wild man. And they just sort of found there were these kindred spirits.
Do you think that because she likes chaos, that she manipulated some of the situations in your family so that it would become more chaotic? When things started to get good, she'd change it.
Mike, I got to tell you, it is readers who pointed that out to me. They were smarter about this book than I have, and that's one of the reasons I love talking to readers. But they've actually pointed that out to me. They noticed some patterns that I think I didn't fully notice. But yes, I think that that's true. She would sort of, if things got a little settled, should unsettle them.
Mm-hmm. Is that why you left, was it Phoenix, and moved to West Virginia?
Bingo. Yep, I think so. I think so.
Because she knew what she was in for when she went to West Virginia. She knew it wouldn't be pleasant.
Yeah. On the other hand, maybe she was looking for his parents to take care of us, because I think that my grandmother always took care of us a little bit behind the scenes in Arizona. And maybe once my grandmother passed, maybe she sort of thought, well, we get to West Virginia, they'll stick us a little money under. Because the thing about Mom is, you know, and this is something I've come to terms with, and some people have asked me, how could you forgive your parents? I think it's less a matter of forgiving and more accepting. That's just the way Mom is. And she can't take care of herself, so how could I expect her to take care of me?
Jeanette Walls is our guest. She's the author of The Glass Castle, a memoir. It's a remarkable story, remarkably told, and we will continue our conversation in a moment from the Belk Centrum at Lenoir Ryan University on Charlotte Talks here on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're coming to you from the Belk Centrum at Lenoir Ryan University. Jeanette Walls is our guest, author of The Glass Castle, which is the story of her life as a child growing up and that of her siblings and her parents. And their lives are like no other that I can think of, unless Charles Dickens is writing the story. It reminded me of somebody taking Charles Dickens and plunking him down in Appalachia.
That's pretty good.
Only worse.
only, please, sir, yeah. I want some more. There wouldn't have been any more to have. Yeah. Your parents, why do you suppose they turned out the way they did? Your father loved you.
Yeah, I think he did.
And you loved him, and you protected him.
Yeah, I think he did.
For a long time. But he didn't know how.
Anybody who's cared about an alcoholic or any addict knows how heartbreaking it is. You keep on wanting to get themselves straight, the addiction is sometimes stronger than they are.
But he was so smart.
He was so smart, and I just kept on thinking he's going to turn it around. This time he's actually going to do it, and he just broke my heart so many times.
Yeah.
And you know, there was one episode where we kids were trying to get out of the situation. We'd saved up money and he just kept breaking my heart, and in some ways it was the worst thing that ever happened to me. In another way, see, I think that everything in life is both a blessing and a curse, and it's entirely up to us which one we choose to focus on. So the worst experience does have a valuable gift wrapped inside. And the valuable gift in that particular episode where Dad basically let me know not only was he not going to build me a glass castle, he wasn't going to take care of us, is it gave me the kick in the behind that I needed to finally realize, I got to get out of here. This is really bad. Yeah. And if anybody's ever going to build me a glass castle, it's going to have to be myself. So we got out.
He knew a lot of things.
A lot.
I don't know how much he knew, whether it was just skin deep or and a mile wide or what. But when you look back on the things that he talks about in this book, was he right? Was he ahead of his time on so many things?
As best I can tell. I mean, I've found some of his papers and I've shown them to experts, and they say, my gosh, this man was really smart. By the time he died, his brain was pretty much pickled.
Sure.
But I've also, while touring, I've run into some people who knew him while he was growing up in West Virginia, and they said, my gosh, your father was brilliant. And it's just a tragedy that this man, but once I met his mother and understood where he came from, to me the shocking thing is not that he was as damaged as he was, but that he had as much good in him as he did. I think that he just had a terrible childhood and just struggled to overcome it.
But you had a terrible childhood.
You know, I did, but I think there was also some magic in it. I was in an event one time, and the readers, it's just fascinating to me. They were arguing in the audience about whether or not my parents were any good. And the larger contingency was against my parents, but a couple of people were vocally defending them. And the woman who was most defending my parents was somebody who was raised on Fifth Avenue in great wealth. Her father was an industrialist and her mother was a socialite. And she said, if my father had one time taken his children out and discussed the stars with us, or if my mother had one time said, don't worry what other people think of you, my life would have been entirely different. So, you know, I think that my parents had the best and the worst of parenting. The other side of the room said, yeah, but you feed your damn children, you know, you got to feed your kids anyway. So they're both right. It's just, you know, which do you choose to focus on?
Yeah. Let me hear from the audience. How many of you think her parents were good? Applaud. Really? How many of you think otherwise? Somebody was really standing and applauding over here on the first part. So at some point when you get your courage up, step up to that microphone and tell us why you feel that way. I'd be very curious to know that. Your parents struck me as I was reading the book. I thought, my God, they're children, particularly your mother.
They're children. That's exactly it. They're children. And that's what you come to understand. I also believe that they loved us in their own damaged way. And I think if a kid gets love and a love of education, that the rest is gravy. You know, the rest is all bonus.
Because your mother just wanted to do what she wanted to do for herself.
Oh, yeah.
She was tired of doing stuff for everybody
else. Oh, yeah,
else.
Exactly. She's a child, and she still is.
why do you think, because we had a little conversation before we started here, and you said that sometimes we don't know who we are until we realize who our parents were.
Exactly.
Something like that.
Uh-huh.
Why didn't this rub off on you?
Oh, it did. It did. In a sort of an opposite way. I mean, one of the great things about my childhood is that I was forced to grow up very early. It rubs off in a different way. But I mean, you know, you can sit around feeling sorry for yourself because you have to grow up early. When I went away to college, I didn't get homesick. It was great. You know, I didn't, you know, There were all these good things about my childhood. You know, on the upside, I'm a fighter and a scrapper. On the downside, I'm a fighter and a scrapper. You know, you learn things. And you know, you can feel sorry for yourself about, oh, poor me. Or you can take those things and run with it. You know, we all have demons. We all have demons. You got to put a harness on your demon and put them to work on for you. You know,
you don't sentimentalize these people, and you don't sentimentalize the situation. And it could have been tempting to do so. We feel your frustration. We feel your concern. We feel your occasional flare-ups of highly justified anger and resentment.
Uh-huh.
Did you ever feel sorry for these people, for what they might have been?
Yes, especially my father, especially. I mean, you know, Dad, like I said, if anybody's ever cared about an alcoholic, you know, it's heartbreaking. It's just heartbreaking. And Dad could have really been spectacular, and he was spectacular when he was sober. You know, and with both of my parents, it's sort of like they were just damaged people, and you just understand that. And my brother got together with my mother one time and tried to get her to apologize for the way we were raised. And I said, Brian, it's not going to happen. Mom doesn't see it that way. And it was a long, difficult conversation. At the end, she said, I did the best I could. And I believe that's sort of true.
We all see things in our own way through our own filter. Let's talk about that for a second, because you have three siblings.
Yeah.
Lillian, Brian, and Maureen.
Right.
Lily, Brian, and Maureen. And I'm sure that they have all read this book.
Right.
Did they want you to write the book?
My older sister, Lori, was, she would have never stopped me, but she could not understand why the heck I'd want to revisit that. My kid sister I hadn't been in touch with for 10 years, and one of the many blessings that has happened as a result of the book is we're back in touch, and she's okay, and she's fine with the book. Writing about Maureen was the most difficult part of the story, and I kept on putting in more of her story and taking it out. And ultimately, my editor said, Jeanette, this is your story, not hers. Don't tell hers. My brother was fabulous from day one. He was the one person I showed the book to as I worked on it. He's got a steel trap memory. I wanted to make sure that my memory and his jibed. He sees things differently. He remembers the cheat as being... I remember the cheat as being gorgeous and noble. Brian said it was mangy and flea-bitten. But, you know, we still both remember it as a cheetah. It wasn't a barracuda, you know, so...
Let's back up for just a second.
Uh-huh.
The cheetah that you're talking about.
Yeah,
your father
right.
took you to the zoo.
And he went over a chain, and we reached through the bars, and we petted the cheetah. And it's my fondest memory after Dad giving me a star. The cheetah licked my hand, you know, and I still remember it.
How old were you then?
I think it was about seven. And I thought it was sort of magical. And I trusted my dad. That's how much I trusted him, because I thought Dad would not let me pet him if it was a danger.
So when you went through when they read the book, or you talked to them about what you were writing in the book, were your memories fairly on target?
Oh, we remember.
Or were you all over the place with different points of view?
We remember... They have not disputed a single thing in my book. Except Lori said something happened in Battle Mountain that I put in Blythe. But other than that, our memories are identical. If any of them had written the book, it would have been entirely different. You know, there are the facts, and then there's the truth. And the truth is squishy. You know, we all have our own truths. And you can all take the facts and do what you will with them. And that was one of the challenges of writing the book, is, well, how did I really feel about these things? And being honest with yourself. The star that I mentioned, that was my favorite memory from my entire childhood. I was 5 years old. We didn't have any money for Christmas presents. And my father let us choose whatever star in the sky we wanted. It's my favorite memory from my entire childhood. I told that story at my father's funeral, and my sister Lori said, isn't that like that sorry dad of ours to go give away something that doesn't belong to him in the first place? You know, same story, different take on it.
Why did you defend him for so long as a child?
Because I needed to. I needed somebody to believe in. He needed me to believe in him, and I needed somebody to believe in. I needed something to cling to get me through, to believe that, first of all, because he had such faith in me, here was the one person who loved me. If he was a no good Nick, then what does his love for me count? So I had to believe that he was worthy of being loved.
At what point did your brothers and sisters see it for what?
Long before me, honey. They were on to him way early on. They, you know, I think my brother had his number when he was about three. You know, Brian is really sharp-eyed. Brian said, "Jeanette, didn't you ever get tired of being people saying, well, you're just a little adult, aren't you?" And that's what he was. He was a little adult.
You know, you spend a lot of time in the book in your childhood.
Yeah.
Because that's when they had the most effect on you, I suppose.
Yeah.
But it was horrible. I mean, no food, bad clothes, no baths, no electricity, no this, no that. And people not, even in West Virginia, where everybody was poor, you were the poorest of the poor.
We were.
And the outcasts. Mm-hmm. No one accepted you. It was difficult to fit in. What kind of resentments, what kind of anger, what kind of residual, I don't know even what to call it, was going on at the time and still maybe exists somewhere in your inner sanctum today?
You know, at the time, it was frustration. I felt that everybody looked down at me, but they didn't understand the whole story. It was very frustrating. I was very hurt, and I definitely was an outcast. I think that's one of the reasons I went into journalism, is it sort of gave me an excuse to go to these events and have my little pad and paper. At this point, I honestly don't believe that there is any resentment. I mean, maybe I'm in denial. Maybe I inherited my mother's capacity to not see bad things. But I am really happy with my... I have a great life. I live in a house with four flush toilets, you know? I'm sitting here talking to a lovely group of people. I have a good life. Why regret or resent how I got here? I think there are many blessings to be had from having a tough childhood. I can go into a grocery store and buy anything I want. That is a miracle to me. I just can't get over it. I don't have to stop at $5. I don't have to ask the grocer if he has any nasty old fruit he's going to throw away. One of the great things about having a childhood like I did is that you understand the difference between wanting things and needing things.
Yeah.
And that's a great blessing if you know that.
How do you think you lived? I mean, you didn't eat, and some of the things
that
you did.
And I'm a big old healthy thing, you know.
But some of the things you did eat, I'm sorry, were disgusting.
They were disgusting. Well, I got to tell you, I have a cast iron stomach today. I still have minor eating issues. The first time my husband tried to eat off my plate, he almost lost his hand. You know, people have real survival skills. When I went to Barnard, and there was this really skinny woman, and she befriended me because she started discussing our eating issues. She thought, and I was like, what? You know, and she thought I was anorexic too. And I'd never met an anorexic. I had no idea. And I started realizing she didn't eat on purpose. Like, what are you talking about? You know, why anybody who's ever had to scrounge around in the garbage can? And then she said that her therapist had told her that she had eating issues because of her mother issues. Is that the case with you? And I said, well, sort of, but that's a weird way to put it. You know, the idea that somebody would starve themselves on purpose, and that's not an issue I'll ever have. Yeah. I've got a really strong survival skill.
But you didn't eat.
I didn't eat.
You never saw a doctor.
Nope.
Didn't go to a dentist.
Until I was 19 years old. First dentist.
And I'm just, I mean, do you think, looking back on this, that we
it's
now...
It's a miracle.
Or do we coddle children today? Do we feed them too much today?
I mean... You know, I don't know. I there are people who argue. There are some child psychologists who say that children are... I'm not in a position to say, I think if you love your child and give them a sense of self-esteem, that's what they need more than anything else. But, I mean, do we over-coddle? I don't think so. I think that if you let kids believe that they're pretty great, that they can get through a lot. And there are kids in they're, you know, I was in an event one time, and this woman sort of shyly raised her hand, and she said, I'm from Uganda, and she didn't have it that bad. So everything is, you know, everything's relative.
And we've been concentrating on a lot of the bad things here, but you just said something that is true. Your parents gave you a sense of a person, that you could do anything, that you can get over anything.
Yes.
And they also had all of you reading
at
by the
age
of five.
I'm a big fan of education. I think that education is the great equalizer. When I needed to get into Barnard, I did okay on the standardized test. My brother's retired from the police force. He said having children made him less sympathetic to mom and dad. He said, you know, Jeanette, it's not that hard to feed your kids. He said becoming a teacher made him appreciate mom and dad a lot more. He said what some of these kids that he's teaching have not been given by their parents. He's teaching in a rough area in Brooklyn. But he said he just assumed that you got certain things from your parents. And a lot of these kids never get it. And we got it in abundance.
Hmm. We're talking to Jeanette Walls, whose first name has two N's in it. Why?
French. It's all fancy.
Because what was you were named after your father, what your father's favorite teacher.
School teacher, exactly.
Who had one N. And exactly. You had her as a teacher as well.
I did. And she died about 3 weeks after The Glass Castle came out, but she read it. And I know this because I was at a convention for West Virginia teachers, and her niece was there being honored. And so I went to speak at her niece's school. And I'm a big fan of education, big fan of teachers. And I think that for a lot of kids out there who don't have a lot, that teacher in their life is the one person, that one guiding light, who gives them what I believe I got from my father, which is a love of learning and a sense that maybe one of these days I would amount to something.
And your mother read voraciously, evidently.
Like a fiend.
Thank God for the public library, huh?
Exactly. Huh. I did not go into a bookstore until I was in my 20s, and I realized this is sort of like a library where you pay the fine in advance, you know?
At one point in the book, you're living in Phoenix in what appears to be a really nice house.
Yeah.
It was a highlight of your life, and you stayed there for how long?
About a year.
That's mm-hmm. all.
It was a long time.
Yeah, because you moved around a lot. Was the nomadic existence of your early life simply to outrun the creditors, outrun the landlord, or because they didn't want to stay in one place for too long?
I think it was all of the above. Yeah.
But the house in Phoenix was paid
some
for.
Some stability, some security. And
it was paid for.
We just left it. We just left it.
You don't understand that to this day, do you?
You know, I think that Mom wanted the chaos. I think she wanted the excitement.
There's a moment in the book, late in the book, and I was going to save this for later, but it's in my head now, so let's get the question asked, and I only have a minute left. I'm sure you can do this. Where you find out that the piece of property that's been paying her dividends in Texas all these years for oil, that her brother passes on, and she wants you to ask her husband to get the money to buy his half of the land.
Right.
And you need $1 million to do that.
I know.
Was it worth $1 million?
If there's oil on it, it is indeed worth that. If there's not, it's worthless. I think, you know, we still have the land. And Mom's always talking, you know, they were going to drill on it back when gas was around $4 a gallon. And I think Mom was a little disappointed because I think she loved the idea of being a millionaire better than she would have loved the reality.
We have to take a break. We'll come back with more in just a moment. Back from the Belk Centrum at Lenoir Ryan University here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE with Jeanette Walls, the author of The Glass Castle. And what you're listening to is a CD that Jeanette Walls was given today at the public library where she was signing books. Tell us about this.
A young man, 12 years old, came up to me and told me he was so moved by my story that he wrote some songs inspired by it. His mother told me that he'd been working on it for 2 years. And I believe this is the one inspired by coming to New York City. There was one about seeing Mom in a dumpster. There was another one, Rex Walls Dies. But I think this was the coming to New York City. 12 years old.
And on the off chance that he might be in the auditorium or that he might be listening, his name is Alexander Jones, and he lives in Charlotte, and we just wanted to play a little piece of his album. I hope it's not copyright protected. It's a great story, though. Obviously, you have inspired a lot of people with this.
It has been so amazing to me. It was just my raggedy little story, and I was ashamed of it, but the degree to which anybody paid attention, I thought it would mostly disappear. Mm-hmm. But I thought the degree to which anybody noticed it, I would be held with contempt and ridicule. And I've learned so much about people and how good and kind and smart they are. But I think more significantly, you know, people come up to me after events like this and they start telling me their own stories. Yeah. And sometimes they start crying and they'll say, I'm so ashamed, I've never told anybody this story before. And I think, why would you be ashamed? That's such a great story. It's a story of courage and triumph. And then I remember, oh yeah, I was ashamed of my story too. But what I've learned is that we all have stories.
If you have a story or a question to share, we have put microphones up on the sides here, and if you can make your way to them, we'll be happy to recognize you and let you ask your own question or make your own comment to Jeanette Walls. Let's talk about Welsh West Virginia.
Yes.
Almost heaven?
There's a couple of folks here from
are
Welsh
you from,
today.
Really? Are you from Welsh?
Area. Yeah, uh-huh.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. They came to the library. We were comparing notes.
Well, know. Like any town, Welsh has a good side and Welsh has a bad side.
Yeah, well,
and
we lived in the poor part of
you
town.
You were in the poor part of town.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Tell us about your house there, for people who have not read your book.
It was... There were three rooms, including the kitchen. It was not wired for electricity. Rather, it was wired for electricity, but we never paid the bills. It wasn't plumbing. There wasn't an indoor bathroom. There wasn't any heat. And it was falling down. And the roof in the kitchen was falling down, and it sort of started traveling into the bedroom, was falling in where the four of us kids slept. And my brother had to sleep with a tarp over him because the snow would come on him. I mean, it was a shack. It was a shack, yeah. And it was falling down.
And this didn't faze your mother at all?
At all. It didn't faze her at all. It was a dump. It was, I mean, the stairs were falling down. I think that's the only thing that kept the child services department away. It's like the stairs were so scary. But, I mean, it was disgusting, yeah. And scary and
they
filthy.
Came once.
They came once and didn't come back.
Why?
I told them I was going to consult with my lawyer. I thought I scared them off, but I think it was the stairs.
You know, it's hard for people to imagine. I mean, it's like living, I suppose, to a great degree in the 19th century or the
No,
or,
it was worse.
Before.
It was absolute squalor. It was, you know, my brother said we live worse than animals. It was just, it's appalling and shocking when I think back on how filthy and disgusting it was. Because when my parents became squatters, I walked into their squat building and it was exactly the same. And seeing it as an adult, I just wanted to throw up. I can't believe that they raised children like that. It was pretty vile.
You know, you hid this very well,
because
when you were at Barnard, there was a moment in the book where you talk about having to get up and talk about welfare.
Yeah, and a teacher asked me, well, what would you know about poverty? And I wussed out. I said, I guess you're right.
What do you know about poverty?
Yeah. And the thing is, I guess I just, for the first time in my life, I was not the daughter of the town drunk and the crazy artist in town. I just wanted to be taken for who and what I was, whatever that means. And I've thought many times about that. I mean, I don't fault my teacher. I sort of fault myself.
Well, how did you know how to live that life? How did you know how to put that mask on? If you lived in squalor and you had nothing you had no television, you couldn't go to the movies, I'm sure. I mean, how did you know how to conduct? How to conduct yourself? Which fork to use at lunch? How to dress yourself? How to do your hair?
It's not rocket science. You sort of watch other people. Like, what do they do? You know, and when I first came to New York, I made some serious dressing faux pas. But, you know, I was 17 at that time. You can make a couple of mistakes. And I started just noticing this is how people behave. Like I said, you watch other people at dinner. I got to tell you, there's a lot of people out there like me, not exactly like me, but the number of people who've come up to me, and they usually wait until the crowds pass, and then they start telling me their stories. And there are a lot of people out there hiding their pasts.
We have some people who have stepped up to the microphones. Brave souls. So have at it. Welcome.
Hi, I'm Reagan from Morganton. And what struck me about your book mostly was the completely unsentimental tone that you used throughout. And I wondered if that was a conscious decision, and if so, how hard it was to stick to that.
You know, it wasn't. I just tried to remember what it felt like as a kid. And I think that a kid isn't that sentimental. I just wanted to describe what I was going through. And I wanted the readers to draw their own conclusions. And that has happened. I didn't want to say... I didn't want to psychoanalyze my parents or put any labels or value judgments on it, because that's entirely up to the reader, whether or not they were good or to interpret them. And readers have done that. So it was a conscious decision. I didn't want to tell the reader how to think. Readers are smart enough to think on their own. Thank you.
Let's move over.
Thank you.
You can applaud. Let's move over to the other side of the room here.
Hi, I'm Diane Dorenzis, and I'm from Granite Falls, North Carolina. And I wanted to tell you that your grandmother is my absolute hero.
Thank you.
And I felt like your mother took a lot of what her mother taught her by knowing what she needed versus what she wanted. And I'm a teacher, and I've been a teacher at a Title I school. And the one lesson that I learned from your book is it's okay to be empathetic towards children of poverty who don't have. It is not okay to be too sympathetic. Because the one gift your parents gave you was that you could get out. And a lot of the children that I deal with will not ever know how to get out.
I love this woman. Thank you. Thank you very much. That's wonderful. Thank you. Thank you.
I would think that your book, if it falls into the right hands, would give people who are in bad situations a great deal of hope.
I have had the most astonishing letters from kids saying, I live in a house that's painted a bunch of different colors, and we drive an old beat-up car, and I've realized if you can make it out, I can too. And it just doesn't get any better than that for a writer. It really doesn't. It's been amazing to me.
Did you know that you were poor?
Not in the beginning. After a while, it became pretty darned obvious, you know? When people are pointing at you saying, look at those poor kids, you realize, you know, they're not doing that out of admiration. But so, yeah, absolutely.
I'm also really curious about your mother's artistic talent, because she spends a lot of time in her life painting. Oh, yeah. Does she still do that, by the way?
Oh, yeah.
And she doesn't... the canvases collect, and the plywood that she's painted on collects.
Uh-huh.
Please, God, tell me that she's good.
Good is such a value, Jasmine. You know, some people... I mean,
Does she have talent? We got a whole
barn full. We got a lot of paintings. In fact, there's going to be a special today for all attendees. 2 for 1. No, the thing... Mom, you know, she needs to paint. And some people think she's got a lot of talent. Some people are less inclined to believe that. I'm not a good judge. I saw these darn things.
What does she paint?
Everything. Everything in every medium, in every style. Now that she's living with us, she paints... they're more exuberant and colorful. When she was living in the city, they were much more morose and melancholy. You know, some people were trying to buy some of her paintings the other day, and she was driving a really hard bargain. She just didn't seem that interested. And I realized she doesn't want to. And I said, Mom, do you want to sell your painting? She said, I don't need the money anymore. So it's not about money for her. It's about painting.
Your mom is 76, and forgive me if we talked about this. We talked before the show. I broke a cardinal rule, and we spoke before the show about the show, which we never do, but we did. And I can't remember whether you told me this backstage or on the stage, and that is that she's 76, uh-huh. and she was, until recently, still living in Homer, in New York, in that squatter's building.
Right,
and did not want to come and live with you in Virginia.
The abandoned building where she'd been living for 15 years caught on fire, and she was back on the streets. And I said, Mom, you know, my husband and I, we've got plenty of room. Come down, live with us. She said, you live in the sticks. I live in the most exciting city in the world. And I said, but you live on the streets. And she said, I'm not a moocher. I'm not a charity case. I said, Mom, we're thinking of getting horses, and we could really use the help. And she said, I'll be right there.
Was it the horses or the help?
I think it was the help, but... interestingly enough, she still rides horses. She grew up on a ranch. She's a good horsewoman, and she's been amazing with the horses, except she's turned them loose a few times because she thinks they should be free. But other than that, they've gotten a little more feral since she's been looking. Other than that, she's been good with them. And I think it's a lot of fun to have her around. She's just, you know, I don't look for her to be a mom, and then she's a hoot.
Yeah.
She's, you know, especially when she's not looking... she's never depressed anymore. She's always up now that she doesn't have kids to take care of. But she's like, she's a child. And if you're not looking for a mom, you know, I've got this really lovely mother-in-law who calls me up. She said, I'm so worried about you. You're working hard. And, you know, I made sure your book was displayed prominently at the local bookstore. And I realized, wow, this is what it would be like to have a mom. I never had a mom, you know. And it's sort of neat. It's a little like getting an umbrella after the storm. But you still, you know, it's still neat. But she's not a bad... I don't think she's a bad person.
Doesn't come across in the book, I don't think, either.
There are people who would disagree, think she's genuinely evil. You know, I just think she's slightly damaged. Regarding your question earlier, is she mentally ill? I'm going to quote... I was on The View one time, and Rosie O'Donnell and Joy Behar actually got into an argument over my mom.
Imagine that.
Imagine. Hard to believe. Joy hated my mom. Said, I can't believe you let that nut live with you. She's a nut, you know. And Rosie was defending her. And she said, there's a whole spectrum of mental illness, all the way from schizophrenia to seasonal affect disorder. And most creative people, including myself, are somewhere in between. And I think that, you know, mom is definitely has a disorder or whatever you want to call it. But she is what she is.
She is who she is. Let's go over here and have at it.
Hi.
Welcome.
I'm Beth from Hickory. Can you tell us a little bit about how you pulled together the stories of your grandmother in your new book?
I interviewed my mother. The book was originally supposed to be about my mom. That was my original intention. Thanks to readers. Readers kept on coming up to me saying, your father, I understand alcoholism. Your mother's a mystery to me. And one of the reasons I'm drawn to nonfiction is the answer's always there if you're willing to dig deeply enough. So it was, I would talk to the readers, and these conversations would usually end with the advice from them, your next book should be about your mother. And I resisted at first because I thought I sort of already told her story in The Glass Castle, but I figured if she's a mystery to them, then I obviously didn't do a good enough job. So I proposed the idea to Mom of writing about her. And I'd been trying to find somebody to write about, and most people, because I have no imagination, I can't make things up, I need somebody to write about. And most people were sort of, had these privacy zones, but Mom was great. Oh yeah, I'll tell you everything, absolutely. But she was the one who said, this book should be about my mother. But I resisted because I couldn't interview my grandmother. She died when I was about 8 years old. But when I sat down to tell Mom's story, I realized Mom was right. It was the stories about her mother that were really compelling. So the stories almost entirely come from my mother. But I called it fiction because I couldn't verify them anyway. I don't know if they're true. Plus, I wrote it in first person from a woman who's been dead for 40 years. So they're just family stories. Thank you.
And so when you were, I asked somebody here the night before we started, is the new book fact or fiction?
Right.
And he said yes.
Yes. Yes, exactly. It is. It is. It's sort of hard to label. I'm not trying to get cutesy with creating a new genre. They're calling it a true life novel, but it's family stories like I'm sure everybody in this room has, that you sit down and you're just like, it's stories that were handed down to you. And if you sat down and put them on paper or on the screen, whichever, could you really say, oh, yes, this is all absolutely true? I don't know. And there were little gaps that I wasn't certain of, so I sort of filled them in. And once you start doing that, you cross the line from nonfiction into fiction.
If you had written this completely as a work of fiction, do you think people would have bought it?
The Glass Castle? Absolutely not. No. People.
You couldn't make this up.
I could never make up my... It's too wacky. It's too weird. Who puts their kids in the back of a U-Haul? Nobody does that. It's too crazy. I could not have written this as... No, I don't think I could have.
Let's go back over here.
Hi, I'm Liz from Hickory.
Hi, Liz.
And I don't really have a question. I just want to say that I am so impressed with your level of acceptance and love for your parents who gave you what they could. And that's why I applauded, because they gave you what they could. And look at you.
Well, thank
and
you.
Look at
thank
where you. Look thank at you. Where you are.
Thank you.
And my parents were born in poverty, and my dad had a sixth grade education. My mom had less than that, and they gave us what they could.
See, this is why I love talking to readers. That was beautiful. You know, that was beautiful.
This is being made into, it's been optioned as a movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Who should play your parents if it becomes a movie?
Oh, wow. I think Susan Sarandon would be fabulous for my mother.
Don't you wish Jack Nicholson was younger?
I do. In fact, my husband's saying Jack Nicholson. Yeah, absolutely.
But younger.
Yeah.
So Jude Law. I'm just kidding. Jeanette Walls has been our guest. She's the author of The Glass Castle, a memoir, and the new book is called what?
Half Broke Horses.
Half Broke Horses is the story of your...
My grandmother. Mom's
grandmom.
Mother. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for telling your story. First of all, having the courage to tell your story and telling it so powerfully.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.